Hi friends, this is Brock Polk, and I want to thank you for downloading this sermon from Heritage Church of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. Our mission is to lead others to a thriving relationship with Jesus, and if you're ready to take a next step in your faith journey after you listen to this message, you can contact us through our website at www.heritagechurchofchrist.org. God bless you, and I hope you enjoy the following message.
All right, how many of your families have already started back to school time by this point? How many of you are starting tomorrow? How many of you still have a whole week off of school? Quite a few of you out here, but most of our families are in that mode this time of year. People are starting to think about class schedules and trying to find their way around the building, especially if it's a new campus. And I've noticed times have changed quite a bit, even since I was in school. You see, on the first day of school, when I was in middle school and high school, I can remember one of the things I was worried about most was that I needed to remember my locker combinations, right? You remember the panic because you're thinking, if I lock stuff in there and can't get it back out, I'm really going to be in trouble. I don't think most of the schools are using lockers anymore, but nowadays students have to remember to charge their laptop the night before school so that they can take notes all day. And that didn't happen, you know, when most of us that are older than this generation went to school. But there's one thing that I know hasn't changed, and I don't think it's going to change, and it's that panicky feeling on the first day or two of school when you first walk into the lunchroom. All right, do you remember what I'm talking about? You remember this feeling about wondering, where am I going to stake my claim? Where am I going to make my spot for this entire school year? I think that was one of the most stressful moments at the beginning of the year for me. It was always in a hurry. I wanted to figure out if any of my friends were going to be in that same lunch period. I didn't want to sit with a group of strangers. And I can still remember the very most stressful of those years. It was the year that I was in seventh grade. Do we have any seventh graders in the room? All right, blessings upon you. When I was in seventh grade, my dad got a temporary job assignment in North Carolina, which meant that we had to move out of Texas for the only time in my life so far, and we went and lived there in North Carolina for 1 year, and we moved in August, and so school started like immediately after we showed up, which means I didn't have anybody, I didn't know anybody when I showed up to school that first day, and my dad and I had charted this path where I was going to ride my bike to school. And somehow, on the day my dad was with me, there were no dogs on that path. And on the day I went by myself, there were big, huge, I mean gigantic dogs. Well, they seemed big at the time. And they chased me, and so I got to school, and I was rattled, and I was nervous about the whole thing. And then came the lunchroom experience, and I just looked around, and it was a sea of strangers. And I remember feeling like, this is nothing like when I moved from fifth grade to middle school or junior high, and I knew some people from my old school. This is nothing like that. All of these people already have their own groups. They've already got their own friends, and I just felt like I was at such a disadvantage. And if you can go back in your own memory to the time when you were 12 or 13 years old, you may remember some of the things I was thinking about and the feelings I was having and the stress that I was under at that moment. And the funny thing is, I don't think that goes away. I mean, you watch adults show up to any place that has general admission seating. All right? And you're going to notice some of the same kinds of behaviors. You watch when adults show up to a conference room or a crowded movie theater, and you will see them mentally negotiating with themselves about where they're going to sit. I mean, first you start by looking around, wondering, is there anybody in here that I know? But you can't count on that. In fact, it's not even very likely in a lot of situations. And unless you were really early, all of the good seats at the back and around the perimeter of the room have already been taken, right? I mean, if you walk in late right now, there are seats available right here on the front row for the people who come in late. But all of you who got here on time or early, you're back in the back. You know, that's how we do. And I, you know, it's like a no man's land. It's like the splash zone up here in the front. Nobody wants to be there. Watch people as they're boarding a Southwest Airlines flight where there's no assigned seating. And they're walking down the aisle, and everybody's looking for that sweet spot of a seatmate who will share the armrest and looks friendly, but also brought a book so it doesn't look like they're going to talk your ear off the entire time. You're looking for the perfect combination. We know the feeling of trying to find a comfortable spot, looking for neighbors who appear to be hospitable and might make room for us at the table and in their conversation. And we also know the feeling of being alone in a crowd, don't we? I've got a friend from college. He worked at a private Christian school on their faculty for a few years. And he tells a story about a sophomore girl who transferred in from public school. And he said she was really quiet, and she was really smart. She came with a great transcript, made great grades at her old school. And she was really pretty. And he said somehow that combination seemed to create problems for her with some of the students who had been at that Christian school for a long time. Apparently some of the other girls felt threatened by her, this new one, like she was a social rival, even though they'd never even spoken. And some of those girls who had been around the school for a while started to spread rumors about her. And she was shunned by some of the students. She was harassed by some other students. And she never got any real relief. And her grades deteriorated and her morale sank as she tried to keep her head up in the face of that hostility. She lasted one semester. And then she went back to public school, where she remembered that people treated her better. And that's a sad story. Nobody loves to hear a story about a young person who's being bullied and mistreated that way. But if you're a Christian listening to that story, it's particularly tragic because you can imagine how that one semester of school is going to affect that young woman's faith for the rest of her life, right? I don't know if she was a Christian or not when she showed up at the school. She went to this school where she had to attend classes about the Bible. She had to go to chapel every day. But you can bet as she left that her experience at the Christian school left her with some questions, wondering about the way she'd been treated by people who professed to be followers of Jesus. Her family, no doubt, paid that private school tuition in the hopes that it would be a nurturing environment for her. But instead, it was an environment where she was never accepted, and it drove her away in the opposite direction. Now, we started a message series last week called Breadcrumbs. And we're talking about the ways that people who are separated from God find their way back. You see, every single one of us knows dozens, probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who are trying to navigate this life without being tethered to the God who created them and loves them the most. Some of these people are our dear friends and our family members. Some of them are our neighbors and our coworkers. Many of them don't even realize that a connection with God is what's missing most from their life. But I believe that as Christians, as followers of Jesus, and as the church working together, we have an opportunity, in fact, we have a mandate to show our community the way back. And it doesn't happen by forcing our beliefs on anybody. It doesn't happen by forcing our behavioral expectations on anybody. It doesn't happen by manipulation. It happens by these small gestures. It happens by these regular invitations to take a few steps toward God. It happens by laying out these breadcrumbs that allow someone to find their way back. In fact, last week we identified that invitations are one of the breadcrumbs that we share. We said that people find their way back to God when they are invited. It's one of the things we can do. And so our challenge last week was to continue inviting so that the people in our circles could be connected to God. And we invite people to worship services and small groups and service activities. And it's not so that this church, this organization, this place Heritage could get any glory. It's so that people that God misses the most could be reconnected back to God. Invitations are incredibly important, and inviting is part of our God-given mission as followers of Jesus. But I need to tell you this week that an invitation by itself is not enough. I've got some family members who live out of state who have become separated from God. I've got some cousins who live in a couple of different states, really, east of the Mississippi, and they have become separated from God. They just, it's not a part of their life anymore. And I love them. And when I think about these family members of mine, we have such good memories together, and I think about them and I think, man, I would love it if somebody who lives in their community, somebody who cares about them, somebody who knows them and is a part of their daily life, I would love it if somebody would invite my cousins to connect with a church. I'd be thrilled if somebody who cares about my cousins would invite them to a small group or a Sunday service. But I tell you, the invitation is not enough. Because I'd be so disappointed if my cousins got invited and decided to show up at a service and then nobody made a connection with them while they were there. Wouldn't that be heartbreaking? I mean, I'd be so sad if I heard that my cousins showed up to try to connect with the church and instead they felt judged and instead they felt excluded or they felt ignored. I'd feel like the parents of that girl who went to the private Christian school. I'd be so disappointed that the Christians didn't make my family feel welcome. You see, if my cousins ever do accept an invitation to visit a church in the state where they live, I am counting on that church to do a good job caring for them and making space for them and welcoming them and making them feel at home, because people find their way back to God when they feel included. People find their way back to God when they feel like they are a part, when they feel like they have a connection. And this means that you and I, we have this opportunity every single week to help people around us find their way back to God by helping them feel included. But it means we got to be ready. We got to be paying attention to the opportunities that God brings our way. We've got to be willing to make room for everyone that God brings, because there's so much at stake. And this morning, I want to talk just a little more specifically about what's at stake. And we're going to look at a kind of an unfamiliar story that's in the New Testament portion of your Bible. It's in the book of Acts, and it's a story that points out just how much is really on the line when a new believer starts to get connected with the church. If you got a Bible with you, you can join me in Acts chapter 9 in just a moment. This is the part of the story of a guy named Saul who was ended up being a church leader. But early in his life, he was not even part of the church. And he lived in the first century, about 2,000 years ago. This was a guy who was a force to be reckoned with his entire life. The first record that we have of this guy named Saul is when he is supervising the public execution of the first Christian martyr, a guy named Stephen. It's in Acts chapter 7. Saul is a Pharisee. He's an authoritarian religious leader of the Jews. And these leaders, they viewed Christianity as an unsanctioned cult and a disturbance and a danger to Judaism. And so they watched for any opportunity they could find to accuse Christians of heresy. And when they found that, they had the authority, the legal authority, to punish them back in those days. And so Paul was committed to this. He wanted to root out any heresy, and he's so good at it, I guess, that he made it his personal mission to identify each and every follower of Jesus he could locate, and he wanted to throw them all in prison. And he did that for a while. And then we get to Acts chapter 9, And he takes his show on the road. He gets this authorization to travel north and go round up a bunch more Christians. And he's planning on bringing back this train of Christian prisoners following him back to Jerusalem. So he's got this violent, this aggressive background. He's an enemy of the Christian church. And every Christian who got near him would have good reason to be very nervous about what was going to happen next. But what happened next was something nobody could have predicted. You see, as Saul was traveling north from Jerusalem, there was a flash of blinding light, and he heard a voice calling him to become a follower of Jesus. It's an incredible plot twist. Nobody saw this coming, but it was a game changer. I mean, you really got to hand it to Jesus for strategy on this one, right? I mean, Jesus is thinking. He's like, hey, who better to share the good news than someone who was a public enemy of the good news until they could no longer resist? I mean, who's going to make a better messenger, a more convincing evidence than this guy who hates everything about this message? So that's what happened. Saul was struck blind by that light, and then Jesus leads him into the city of Damascus, and there's a Christian there named Ananias who was deathly afraid of Saul, but the Lord comes to Ananias and says, I need you to go see him. Ananias says, wait, hold on. I'm not sure I want to do that. You know who this is, right? He says, yes, I know who that is. He's the one I have chosen to take my message to the world. He's the one I have chosen to spread this good news far and wide. And so Ananias got there, and he was given the power to heal Saul's blindness, and Saul was immediately baptized, and he became a Christian. It's the most literal example of this principle that people find their way back to God when they are included, because Ananias did not want to include Saul, but he did it anyway. He showed up. He was obedient. He didn't want to help, but he obediently went, and his decision to accept Saul, to include Saul, led to the beginning of Saul's Christian life, and what a life it was. You see, Saul, that's a Hebrew name. But if you translate that name into Greek, it sounds more like Paul, as in St. Paul, as in Minnesota. As in, we're talking about a guy who would become one of the most significant Christian leaders in the early church. We're talking about a guy who wrote more books of the Bible than any of the other authors. We're talking about a guy who wrote some of the most memorable and influential passages in all of the scriptures. We're talking about a guy who went on to change the world in the name of Jesus, and it almost didn't happen because Ananias was scared to meet him. There was a lot on the line. There was a lot at stake in this connection. And that's not the only time that this single connection made a difference. You see, here's what happened next. After staying in Damascus for a while, Saul learned that the Jews, who used to be his allies, the Jews in that city had hatched a plot, a conspiracy to kill him. He was a traitor as far as they were concerned. And so his Christian friends snuck him out of the city. They sent him to Jerusalem, but he's got a problem in Jerusalem. The last time he was in Jerusalem, he was overseeing the public execution of a Christian. That's not the kind of thing people forget very easily. And so the Christians in Jerusalem are not excited about Saul's return or his arrival. In fact, Acts chapter 9, verse 26 says, when Saul came to Jerusalem, he tried to join the disciples. He wanted to be connected. But they were all afraid of him. They didn't believe that he was really a disciple. Now, you got to put yourself in their shoes here, right? These people have a lot of reason to be skeptical about Saul. I would have been skeptical about Saul. They knew what he was capable of. They had seen his work. They had attended Stephen's funeral. They knew what this guy had done in the past, and they don't trust him. They don't believe he's being genuine about his faith. In fact, they believe he might be trying to infiltrate the church as a spy, and so there's this standoff. Saul wants to be let into the Jerusalem church, and the Jerusalem church doesn't trust Saul enough to let him in. And that sounds like a small, isolated situation, but there is so much hanging in the balance in this standoff. I mean, if this church doesn't welcome Saul, chances are his missionary work never happens. Chances are, if they can't move past their deadlock with each other, Paul doesn't go on to plant churches all over Asia Minor and Southern Europe. Chances are he doesn't write any of the letters that make up our New Testament. And so we don't get verses and chapters like Romans chapters 8 and 12, which are some of the most encouraging passages of Scripture in the lives of so many of us. We don't get chapters like Philippians 2, where we are reminded of the ultimate purpose of our faith, which is to imitate Christ. We don't get some of those writings like Colossians 1. We don't get some of these things that have helped us to grow in our faith. It would have changed the course of history if Saul and the Jerusalem church couldn't work it out. And so this stalemate matters. There's a lot on the line, and one guy from the Jerusalem church shows up and he makes a difference. Read the next verse with me. Verse 27 says, Barnabas stepped up and testified on Saul's behalf. Barnabas took Saul. I can imagine, he just kind of grabs him by the arm. Come with me. He took him and he brought him to the apostles. These are the people who had been with Jesus. Brought him to the apostles, and Barnabas told them how Saul on his journey had seen the Lord and that the Lord had spoken to him. And he told the apostles about how in Damascus Saul had preached fearlessly in the name of Jesus. You know, I don't think it would have worked out the same if Saul had gone in and tried to tell his own story. Do you? Well, let me tell you about what happened to me on the road to Damascus. Yeah, we're not sure we believe that. Well, let me tell you about what I couldn't see for 3 days. And yeah, sure. How are you going to verify that one? Well, let me tell you about what happened. These people, we don't know these people in Damascus. How are we going to verify any of that? But Barnabas comes and Barnabas knows the story. And Barnabas testifies on Saul's behalf. He stepped in and he made a huge difference, not just for the future of the church. He had no way of knowing what was going to happen in the rest of Saul's life. But in that moment, Barnabas made a huge difference for Saul personally. He made sure that Saul was included, and it took some effort. It required some personal investment from Barnabas. I mean, first, he himself had to learn about Saul's story. He had to be curious. He had to be inquisitive enough to know about Saul's background and listen to everything that had happened in his spiritual journey. He had to care for someone that nobody else in the spiritual community had learned to care for yet. And then he saw this standoff developing, and Barnabas took the opportunity to share Saul's story. And did you see how he did it? First, he invited Saul, come meet with the apostles. And then he helped him make connections. He included him. He made sure that his story was connected to the church's story. He didn't convert Paul or Saul personally, but he showed up at a critical moment to make sure that Saul continued to find his way back to God. He was putting out breadcrumbs, just making sure that this guy was not allowed to disconnect again. And it worked. Barnabas was able to convince the apostles that Saul's conversion was real. And the next verse, verse 28, says, so Saul stayed with them, and he moved about freely in Jerusalem, and he spoke boldly in the name of the Lord. And that was his next step, and maybe the most critical step, the most critical phase in jump-starting his ministry. And it all happened because Barnabas made sure he was included. That's one of the key ingredients to helping people find their way back to God. But you already knew that, didn't you? You already sensed that. You're smart people. You're experienced people. You already understood the value of being invited and included. You already understand how that makes you feel welcome. You already knew that when someone on the inside makes space for you, it helps you begin to feel like you could be an insider too, right? You already knew that. I mean, think about the college fraternities and the sororities. Think about all the recruiting, all of the invitations, all of the events where they make a big ta-da about saying, come, we'll make room for you. Come and be a part of this community. Come and be a part of this group and we'll make space for you. Think about the way people go out of their way to follow and retweet and connect with their favorite celebrities because they're just hoping that somebody, maybe some celebrity will like one of your tweets or retweet yours and you'll feel connected. Think about the commitment that goes into all of the pro sports teams and all of the money and effort we spend trying to identify ourselves as diehard fans. You remember that old TV show, Cheers, don't you? The whole thing, I mean, nearly the entire show is centered in a basement bar in Boston. And if you watch one of those old episodes, you can look around in the background and the bar is almost always full. There's tables all around the perimeter of the room and there are usually people occupying those tables, but we don't ever find out about any of those people. They're on the periphery. None of those are regulars. They're not part of the community. Nobody stops what they're doing to greet these extras when they walk into the room. But when one of the main characters walks in, when someone who's part of that little community shows up, everybody stops to acknowledge that they've arrived. Norm, they say. And Norm and all the rest of the regulars keep coming back. And why do they come back? It's because they've been included. It's because they've been included in the community. They've been able to participate. Somebody's saved them a stool. Somebody saved them a spot. It's where their family is. And you know, and I know, this isn't a surprise to you, you know that the entire world is looking for a place to belong. Everybody in our world's looking for a place to belong, and we just keep searching until we find it. And we're praying that somewhere along the way, God might lead others to our church so that they might receive an invitation to our church. We're praying that people would stop here in their quest to belong. But I'm convinced that unless the church finds a way to include those who show up here for the first time, church is just going to be a brief stop in their search for belonging. We have an opportunity, we have a responsibility to make a space and to offer hospitality to the people that God is bringing to us. And I got to tell you, He's bringing a lot of people. Every single week in this room, I meet people who are here for the first time. Every single week. I see a list of people who are visiting our church, trying to decide if this will be home. And every single week, I meet people here for the first time that don't make a second return visit. And that's not all on us. I said last week, I'm not sharing these messages out of disappointment. This is an opportunity. This is an invitation for us to be inviters and includers, because God is bringing people to us. And if you look back over your own spiritual history, I hope you can remember people that made an effort to include you. I think back on some of my spiritual story, my biography, and there are some mentors and there are some teachers and professors and some youth ministers and people like that, but that made a big difference for me. But the ones that really probably made the biggest difference might not even know it, because it was people like Betty Herring who taught my second grade Sunday school class. It was people like Don Cartwright who invited me to be part of a service project with him when I was in high school. And we just would work for hours on preparing some stuff for children's ministry, and he didn't know that he was making an indelible imprint on my life. It's people like the preacher, maybe some of you have heard me talk about, who helped to convert my granddad. I never met him. But 70 years ago, because he included my granddad, the exponential effect allows you to hear this message this morning. And I think back to some of the stories that are represented in this room. I think back to people who found their way into this room for the first time, and sometimes they came by themselves, and it was a mom or a dad, and they said, I need some help. And they showed up and they found that there was a community here that wanted to care about them and wanted to love them. And then suddenly they started bringing their family. And then suddenly their parents started coming. And then suddenly they had neighbors who started coming. And you start thinking about the width, the breadth of the influence and the impact that it had, because somebody stood at the door and remembered their name when they showed up the second time. We got to be people who are including. When we do that 60-second greeting thing at the beginning of the service, we got to be people who are including. We got to be people who are looking around for someone who might not be connected. Say, I want you to know that this community cares for you. We got to be people who are including, the way that God had made sure we were included. And when we look back on this story of Jesus, this good news about the love of Christ, there may not be any part of it that's more moving than the fact that God included us when we didn't deserve that. And that's really what the gospel's all about.